The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. It's 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 28th of April, 2023. And you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show. We have our Friday panel joining us shortly. A little later on, Michael and Fanula will be in talking all things entertainment and lots more besides. We want you involved in our conversations. WhatsApps and text 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000, and emails to comments at highlandradio.com. We'll be going to our Friday panel very shortly, but first... As you heard in the news there, the people who have very sadly died in a crash near Auchnacloy in Tyrone have been named locally as Dan McCain, his sister Christine Duffy, and their aunt Julia McSorley. They were killed on the A5 Tullyvar Road when their minibus collided with a lorry. Four others in the minibus were seriously injured and taken to hospital. Father Declan Boland is the Strabane Parish priest, and he joins us on the programme. Thanks for taking the call on the most difficult of mornings, Father.
Very much so, Greg. Our hearts are broken today. This unspeakable tragedy has hit us totally without any notification whatever. We're deeply saddened and we're trying to comprehend the enormity of what has happened. As the news broke yesterday, the extent of it, a brother and a sister and an aunt, a lovely, lovely family, the McCain family, travelling back from Corby in England, where they had been attending the funeral of an aunt, to be taken out so tragically. It's really difficult to come to terms with the dimensions of this loss, Greg, this morning. And the whole community of Strabane is mourning, and Newton Stewart too, because Julia, the aunt, even though she was from Strabane originally, she lived there. So there are three communities, our parish here, Melmount, and Newton Stewart.
Yeah, man, I think there might be also family across the border here in Donegal. And how does anyone process this type of information, Father? Because you have family who are hearing of this awful loss and at the same time hoping that others make full and speedy recoveries. It's just too much sometimes for the mind to comprehend, isn't it?
And indeed, when you have a multiple tragedy like this, you're at any tragedy, you're totally at sea. But when there's a multiple tragedy like this involving the same family, words just lose you. You're lost for words. Words are inadequate. Yesterday, in Christine Duffy's home, people were just gathering. There was a silent solidarity. Groups meeting, people hugging, lots of tears, lots of prayers. People bringing refreshments, people just standing there and solidarity, not having the words, but their very presence brought a great sense of support to the family as they try to unravel these events. And thankfully, two of the siblings who were badly injured, they're now in post-operative care in the RVH, and they're expected to come through. And another sibling, William, and his wife, Anne-Marie, they were discharged from hospital yesterday. So in the midst of all the tragedy, at least we have the news that the others are going to be okay.
Like most areas, this area, it's not the first tragedy that has visited and that has to be dealt with. And the one thing we know is the community will come together, and as impossible as it seems right now, will come together and rally around and support one another and come through this.
You can say that 1,000%. This family come from an area in Strabane, which is called the head of the town. Mm-hmm. It's a close-knit community. They're a loving community. They're extremely supportive. And they have already started to show that solidarity, Greg. And I know in the difficult and trying days ahead, they will be there for this family. And this unspeakable tragedy, they will help the family through this. Mm-hmm. I know the faith of the people will see them through, but it will not prevent us from having to face into the horror of the bodies coming home and the funeral services, etc. Mm-hmm. But we will get there, And this evening in Strabane, we're having a rosary at the grotto. There's a grotto very close to where the family live. And the local people are asked to gather there. And funny, the last time we gathered there, Greg, was for the Christoph victims. Mm. The victims of Christoph, and we've had other individual tragedies where we gathered there as well.
And similar to that, Father, this is one of those tragedies that even if people aren't directly affected, the ripples pass through a community. And I think an opportunity like that's being presented tonight might give those listening to this news and struggling with it an opportunity to get with others, because there is comfort in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is a time when words and sentiments and the usual things we say when somebody dies or when there's a tragedy, somehow these things are ring hollow. And just to see people gathering, to witness people gathering, and that sense of communal grieving at a deep level, unspoken, is very, very powerful. It's a wonderful witness. And can I say this morning as well, I was on radio also this morning, and the parish priest of Auchnacloy was on. Can I thank the people of Auchnacloy and the parish priest? They're having a mass there tonight and candlelight vigil. Can I thank the first responders and the people of Auchnacloy for showing such care to our beloved family, the McCain family, who were visited by this unspeakable tragedy and this unspeakable grief, Greg. I want to publicly acknowledge that this morning.
And listen, so many people, the first responders, as you mentioned, the families, the friends, all affected by this, and you yourself as well, Father, have to show great strength at a time like this. So we offer you all our thoughts and prayers and whatever strength can be mustered to try and get through the next couple of days. Thanks. And the long road ahead, because I recognise that the likes of yourself and the police and ambulance services, this impacts so many different people. Father, thank you for your time.
And thank you for those sentiments, Greg. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Father Declan Boland there, who is the Strabane Parish Priest. We'll be back introducing our Friday panel after this short break. Our guests on the Friday panel this morning are Emma D'Souza, writer, campaigner, peace builder, founder and founder of the Civic Initiative, and Paddy Rooney, PRO of the Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. Good morning to Emma. Obviously, I wanted to sort of try and separate that awful tragedy out from our conversation, but not do so in such a way where we couldn't just reflect on it. It wouldn't be fair on either you or Paddy, Emma. But I mean, it's just, as I said to Father Boland there, it's unimaginable, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, it's such an imaginable trauma and loss to have happened. And it's not too far up the road from myself, Auchnacloy. I'm out near Five Mile Town, and it really is impacting right across the community. It's very hard to process in terms of how the community and the family now recover from such a loss. So it's definitely a difficult time.
Yeah, and Paddy, you know, mentioned to Father Boland there about the importance of community, and Strabane certainly not wanting in that regard. It's going to be a tough couple of days, weeks, months and years ahead. Just an awful thing to be visited on a family and community.
I expect that it will, Greg, because of the suddenness and I suppose the age of the people that were involved. I mean, in my own extended family, we had two funerals within the last 10 days. My mother-in-law was coming to the end of life, but my sister-in-law was not, and she died very suddenly. And the outpouring of grief for the elderly member of the family was one thing, but it was brought up a much higher level for my sister-in-law. So I can only imagine for the community, you know, the triple loss, it's absolutely terrible. Mm. And I think that the family themselves will be relying on the community for support and help over the coming days in particular, because time will heal all this tragedy, Greg, such as it is, you know.
Okay, and condolences to you and the family, Paddy, on what you've been going through.
That's right.
Let's get to some of the stories then that have been making the headlines. It's kind of ironic us talking about this because yesterday we were talking about, you know, distraction politics, and maybe this just feeds into the wider conversation. But as we know now, Minister of State in the Republic for Skills and Further Education, Niall Collins, he said he had no doubt that his actions in relation to the sale of land in County Limerick in 2008 were legally correct. He was giving a personal explanation in the Dáil after it was revealed his wife purchased land from Limerick County Council in 2008 after he attended a meeting of a local area committee where the sale was proposed. Mr. Collins said the process was all done in full transparency and that the sale occurred when he was no longer a member of the council. There are some questions, though, that remain. The key one being, I think, anyway, was he aware when he participated in that meeting that agreed to put the land up for sale that his wife had expressed an interest in buying it, because obviously you'd expect him to recuse himself at that point. There's also two versions of the one council document relating to the decision now circulating, one which refers to buyers with a second name redacted and another with just which just has Niall Collins' wife's name on it. Okay, so how big a story is this, or are we looking over here when we should be looking over there, in your view, Paddy?
Well, am I right in saying, Greg, that the origin of this story came from the Ditch magazine?
Yeah, it's an online publication.
An online publication, yeah. And, you know, they seem to be very successful or active recently in digging up this, because this story goes back some time. I suppose the thing, is it a distraction? Well, Donna Grab, the foreign secretary in Britain, had to resign over a report into his behaviour with civil servants, the word that he was deemed to be bullying them or whatever. And I'm not trying to sort of weigh one against the other, but Paul Murphy, the People Before Profit TD, was on RT this morning and he was quoting legislation now in relation to, or the rule book in relation to public reps at local and national level about what constitutes a conflict of interest and what they can and can't do. And he was able to match the behaviour of Niall Collins. And I'm talking about the meetings that he was at and what he had said and the meetings that he had recused himself from. And it seems that he did cross the line, even though the government, all voices coming from the government are adamant that he didn't break any law. And he's constantly saying that, you know, I didn't break any law. Well, Paul Murphy is making the case that he actually did. And the other thing is, I suppose the commentary around this, Greg, is the fact that if you look at what happened or how Niall Collins has been protected in inverted commas by the government at the moment, and you compare that with how Barry Cowan was dealt with, he was sent on his way very, very swiftly, but the wagon seems to be circled around Niall Collins to make sure that he stays. Is that solely because the voting numbers in the Dáil now are much tighter than they were at the outset of the government, or is it something else? But it is a feature. There is some degree of shabbiness about this, the fact that people who find themselves elected to power and then that they use that power. I'm not saying that this happened in this case.
But not answering questions either. You see, sometimes I think politicians can be their own worst enemy, because we heard Leo Varadkar saying, look, if he answers questions, we can't have the Dáil being a kangaroo court. But many of them, people have answered questions in the past. Pascal Donoghue in the not-so-distant past. And there's two very obvious questions. Like, was his wife's the only person that had actually expressed an interest in this land beforehand, and did he know? Whose other name is on this council document? You know, questions that can only be answered if he allows himself to be questioned on it. And then what I really can't understand is that all three leaders of the government parties are allowing themselves to be dragged into this. So as toxic as it might get now, they are all, they've got no distance between themselves and this controversy. I don't buy the numbers thing, because I imagine there's at least one or two TDs out there that would come back into the fold if Fine Gael needed them to do so, you know, because I think there's a couple of loyal ones there. So I don't understand why they're handling it in the way that they are.
Well, I don't for the life of me understand either why they're taking the approach that they are, because there must be tons and tons of PR people around Niall Collins advising him what to do and what to say. Robert Troy the TD from Longford, Westmeath, or whatever. He was in the very same predicament back, was it last year? And he adopted the same approach as Niall Collins did. You know what happened to him? Eventually, the storm got so severe, Greg, that he actually had to resign. The only reason I think that Niall Collins won't go into Dáil Éireann and to answer questions is because he has something to hide. If he had nothing to hide, what would be the problem? And he would nip this in the bud. This is going to drag on and drag on and drag on, and it'll probably build up in a crescendo fashion into something that could blow up in his face.
Emma D'Souza, I mean, you know, I mean, you can talk obviously to the actual story itself, but the big loser here is politics, because it's just another reminder to the public of what goes on, or what we don't know goes on, or the you know, what's being covered up, what's not being covered up. I mean, it just reflects really, really poorly on the whole system.
Yeah, and I mean, I would add that I found it particularly galling when parliamentary privilege was used to actually sort of try to undermine the work of the Ditch and the journalists that are doing this story. I thought that that in particular was a concerning messaging to come out from party leaders yesterday in terms of not addressing and actually answering the questions that do need to be answered, instead taking this sort of attack on the press instead, was, I think, quite concerning.
Well, it was almost out of the Trump handbook, wasn't it? Because Micheál Martin effectively implied that the Russians are pulling the strings here. I mean, that is Trump style.
There's a political agenda. You know, at the end of the day, those of us in the media have a responsibility to hold politicians to account. That is part and parcel of being a free press. And the language that was used, especially the linking to Russia, was really quite concerning. And to use that under parliamentary privilege is a point of concern. But to Patrick's point as well about the crescendo here, look, this is going to go in an inevitable way. There's obviously something not right about this story. It's going to build up. It's going to get to a point where there's going to have to be answers. It's not going to go away. And in the end, this position may indeed be untenable. So, you know, why drag it out? Because it does actually weaken the faith that people in the public have in the political institutions. It creates this environment where the public are not sure if they can really trust what our political leaders are saying. So it does have a damaging effect on public discourse and public view of politics. To the wider point around distraction politics, yes, I think we do live in an era where there is a tendency for kind of distraction politics, or for the media in a way also to sort of lean into stories that can maybe get more clicks on a page, and that can be a challenge. It's part and parcel, I think, of living in a digital era where social media has become so dominant, and it does kind of lend itself into that sphere. I think in Ireland, it's maybe not as extreme as it is in the UK. I think in the UK, we have a serious challenge around the Conservative Party using kind of the quote culture wars as a way to try and stir up tension. And that's something that we have to try and manage.
Yeah, and I think that came to the fore, didn't it, during the week. Jacob Rees-Mogg was in an interview with a lady whose name I just don't have in my head, if the truth be told. And she was making a strong point in that regard. And it kind of feeds into this conversation, isn't it? That it actually, not only just the media, but it suits politicians for us to be talking about stuff that is not insignificant, don't get me wrong, but really it doesn't put bread on the table, it doesn't put a roof over the house, it doesn't get you a roof over the head, it doesn't get you into the GPs or the hospital. Paddy, are we all part of something here, not us literally as such, though, where, you know, it suits people for us to have our eye off the ball? And, you know, the opposition are complicit in it, because they're not going in saying, hold on, yeah, whatever's happened with Deputy Collins here, what about this? This is the big crisis here. They're saying, right, we can possibly actually unsettle this government. We're going to keep at it, keep at it, keep at it. I can't remember what it was before the Easter break, because there's so much stuff that comes along. But 2-3 weeks, no meaningful stuff discussed. It was just about point scoring. I think we've had enough of it now, Paddy. We want our issues fixed now.
You see, I don't know how we've got ourselves into this situation, Greg. And I'm talking about us now in society in general, because it appears to me anyway that the more educated we are in this country and the more tools we have to bring information to us, the less we want it, or the less we can. Either we can't cope with it or we don't want to cope with it. We're more interested in sort of day-to-day living, or we're more interested in Netflix TV and Amazon Prime and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you look at the dilemma, for instance, facing RTE management at the moment, but who's going to replace Rich Ryan Tuberty for the Late Late Show? And the predicament is that apparently that there's very low viewership under 40 years of age, the people that are watching the Late Late Show and current affairs programmes. And the problem for that then is that advertising aimed at that audience, there's no point advertising if people aren't going to be watching the programme. So what are they watching? Well, they're watching, like myself, I don't watch the Late Late Show, I'm watching something else like Netflix or so on and so forth. I mean, I have three adult children and they watch a minimal amount of mainstream TV and probably less radio. So are they and people of their ilk interested in action? Are they interested in Niall Collins at all? Do they even know that this issue is a topic? I mean, they see it.
They aren't interested. My two oldest boys have I don't think they've ever really watched scheduled TV, if I could call it that. It's either Netflix, YouTube or something. They simply don't. And they wouldn't. And they probably would be. But they do have. They're just interested in different things. It's not that they're zombies. Like, they're just interested in different things. And I think you're perfectly right. So you saying then that there is a shrinking audience, Paddy, or appetite for the complicated stuff, the day-to-days, the stuff that is really meaningful.
We're soon at a situation in this country, I suspect, that, remember, there's only 6 out of 10 people that are entitled to vote in this country actually do. And I'll be very surprised if that number remains that high in years to come. It'll probably be less than that. It's a lot less than that. The engagement in Britain is a lot less than that. So people are not voting. They're not putting a political person or party into power that's going to advocate on behalf of their interests. They're disengaging. They're not watching the news. They're not watching current affairs. They're in, you know, day-to-day living, or they're watching sport, or they're watching movies or whatever. I mean, it's probably safe to say that there's a good 50% of the population out there are not engaged and they don't care, Greg.
No, and they're not on Twitter arguing either, because their life is just, they've got other things going on, or any social media. But Emma, it's our fault then to some extent. You've been involved in campaigns. You know what can be achieved. It's a terrible struggle, I know that, but it can. People themselves can make a change. We've seen what the people affected by defective concrete were able to achieve. Okay, it's not quite there yet, but they were able to force something across the line. And we've seen that historically when people have taken to the streets and risen up, that change can be affected. But if we are all just sitting on our hands, you know, and we are only clicking, you know, who's going out with whomever, maybe the media and the politicians are playing to the audience, and we're the audience, and this is what we want.
Yeah, I think it's a wider problem around a very disillusioned population, where we have a political system that is not operating as best as it could. People are suffering. There are significant challenges around basically how people are living their lives, the housing crisis, the young people that are having to leave en masse for better opportunities. And people just don't see politics as something that's working and look to different ways to affect change. We see that particularly with younger demographics, where young people are now turning away from going to the voting booth and instead opting to do digital campaigns or protests or other ways to be part of a community. And those ways do exist. And it's also part of a global agenda as well, because now we have, with the rise of social media, we have a global community where people can engage in social change on a much larger scale online than they can perhaps in their own community. So it kind of all plays into this wider picture, and it creates a challenge. Really, it creates a challenge around democracy and how you try to increase participation in political processes. And it ties into this bigger conversation around how effective our political institutions are, can they be strengthened? And we need to find a way to try and inspire particularly the next generation to try and use that avenue. And it does come down, I think, again, back to the social media stuff. Look, it's maybe not Twitter, but now we have the rise of TikTok as well, where people have, you know, 10 seconds is maybe what you have tops to be able to try and get someone's attention, and then they're going to move on to something else. So as a society, the way we are consuming our media is changing at a rapid pace. And that creates challenges for how you're reporting the news, how you're getting across issues to the populace, and how you're trying to strengthen democracy in the long term.
And I think we had another brilliant example of this week, in that Tucker Carlson left Fox News. Now, there's a population of, what is it, 340, 350 million people in the United States. Tucker Carlson's nightly viewership at its best was 3.5 million, 1% of the United States population. And yet his departure was global news, led the BBC, led RTE. You would swear something had happened to the president over there or whatever. That being said, he posts a 2-minute clip on Twitter, which has, last time I checked, 60 million views, a 2-minute clip. Now, if that is not an indication as to how things are changing, for good or bad, I'm not quite sure. You know, he went from effectively talking to himself percentages-wise on American TV to having this global audience of 12 times our population. Paddy, where do you see it going? Because I say, I think that really underlined how different things are for me. It was a really good recent example of how things are changing, especially in a small country like this. You talked of the viewership for RTE. I mean, in 5 years' time, no one will be watching live TV on RTE, I don't think. Paddy, can you hear me? No, Paddy's frozen there.
Okay. Not.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. No, I was just talking to, I waffled. My point is that it's clear, it's demonstrated recently how people consume stuff is changing.
Well, the most recent AGM of Media House, the company that owns the Irish Independent newspaper, said that the Irish Independent will stop. It will be in paper form. It will stop being published in paper form within 5 years. So you go into a newsstand, you won't find the Independent newspaper there. You'll have to look it on your phone or your tablet or whatever. And it's going to change in a very big way. And you see, looking at media on your phone, it's not that it's difficult, but it's much harder to read a long article than it is to read it on a hard copy of newspaper in front of you. But this is all like trying to pick up mercury with the spoon, Greg, because political parties, do they actually stand for anything anymore with the exception of possibly the Green Party? Because what political parties are doing now, and this started off in the United States, is they're carrying out focus groups, and whatever's coming back from the focus groups, that's their policy. So political parties and the media, to a degree, are giving the people what they want, but they're not giving them what they need. And quite often they don't give them what they need because it's too unpopular. Like the Green Party are advocating on behalf of climate change issues. They don't do well as a rule in rural constituencies because it's many of their policies seem to be anti-farming and anti-rural or whatever. So what chance have we got then if, you know, the political parties are just giving us back what we've given to them? And, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we had 4 or 5 political parties who stood for something, all stood for different things, to give us a choice? The problem for us, you see, Greg, is there's no choice and we don't care who gets into power. I mean, somebody said recently on the radio, and I'm not able to tell you who said it, and they referred to Sinn Féin, is the closer Sinn Féin come to power, the closer they look like a party of power. Mm. Okay? So we may have expectations of something grand and different from Sinn Féin if and when they get into power, but the probability is it will be the same old, same old.
Yeah, and Emma, what's happening too, I think, what we are seeing too, is that parties, any of them, then are actually going with the flow. In other words, they're going with what's popular. They're trying to play to the masses. Whatever is being talked about or attitudes in certain places, they'll go with that. And then what happens with the media too, I think, as they become, as we become, I can't make out, pretend I'm different. Well, we're doing very well, thankfully, but we're independent. But the further they, the more difficult it is to make a living, like with newspapers and TV stations and what have you, so they pick a side. So they have, and you've seen that in America now, so you'll have a network, will pick the Republican side or pick the Democrat side. Then you've got half the population in a bubble, the other half in a bubble, and it just keeps the media ticking along for another wee while. But where does it all end up, Emma? Because I think things are changing. We can never go back to where we were. So, but I don't know where we're going either. Like, is it something like Black Mirror where we'll just vote on things on our phones? Because you would just
sometimes
have to go
Black Mirror cuts a bit too close to home. I don't know about the rest of you, but for me, sometimes it doesn't seem too far-fetched for some of those directions of travel. I think the point that Patrick's making around how it's increasingly difficult to see the difference between political parties is very, very accurate. They are kind of all cut from the same cloth and change whichever way the wind goes in terms of what's a popular policy instead of what actually needs to be addressed. In Northern Ireland, we face particular challenges because, of course, we have a continuing situation here in the media where we have, for example, the Newsletter, which is a unionist leaning newspaper. Then we have the Irish News, which leans more to a nationalist audience. And then we have the Belfast Telegraph, which would lean somewhere between the two. But that kind of representation within the media, where it's playing to one community or another. In the US, you have, of course, a Democrat and Republican. It does create challenges for democracy. It creates challenges for politics. It creates challenges for how people can engage with the political system. We have seen that there's been now a 15-year decline in democracy on a global scale, and there is a significant rise in populist politics and populist tactics. And that, I think, is beginning to seep into politics here in Ireland as well, and creates a challenge for how the media responds to that in a very, very fast changing landscape.
Yeah, and last one on this before the break, Paddy, let me put it to you. I mean, you, as Emma is, and me to some extent, you know, you follow politics and you have an interest in it and what have you. But I do get a sense of, I don't want to put, you can describe it yourself, that maybe you feel disillusioned in it or the system currently. But whatever you do feel, give me the word, you articulate yourself. But I'd be curious if you kind of are disappointed with the direction of traffic when that began, if that makes sense. We're trying to timeline where people like yourself might have become, and I'll use your own words, but just frustrated with the system, that you started seeing this blend of all things seem to be the same cheek of the one bum, if you know what I mean.
Well, when did it happen, Greg? Well, I suppose it's like the lines of the book, Ernest Hemingway's book about, yeah, ask somebody, how did you go, when did you go bankrupt? Well, gradually and then suddenly, I suppose. It happened over a 20-year, it happened over, I suppose, a 20-year period, but it's been exasperated very, very badly over the last 2 years. And I think there's a direction of travel at the moment that is unstoppable. And there will be probably a new phase and a new life beyond the current trend. And I don't know what that is, but we're heading headlong anyway into the digital age and digital media. And I don't think that's something that we can stop.
No? Okay. Listen, thank you so much for your contribution so far. You're listening to Emma D'Souza, a writer, campaigner, peace builder and founder of the Civic Initiative, and also Paddy Rooney Pirro of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. And you're keeping us busy on the phones as well. Caller says the doll is a bubble where once inside it, all about the politicians' interests and citizens' needs are forgotten or ignored or talk no action. Also, there is apathy towards these controversies because, as usual, the rules don't apply to the political class. One rule for them and corporate interests, and another for ordinary citizens. Another, people have copped on to the extent of media bias that was out there. If it wasn't The Ditch, it would have been some other outlet to call out the scandal and the bias reporting. But you could argue that, as I say, we were going to move on, but I'll just stick with this. But you could argue that The Ditch is part of biased reporting in that it is very much established to call out issues in politics, primarily with whichever party is in power. That happens to be the Greens, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil at the moment. I mean, we can't pretend that The Ditch are the saviour of independent journalism either, really, could we? And I don't mean that with any disrespect to them, Paddy, but I mean, they're just the opposition of The Independent, for example. Or is that going too far, I wonder?
Is that, that's directed to myself?
Yes, anyone will take it at this stage after that silence.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you see, if you look at, if no, there was a sort of a wee cut in my
theme. I understand.
But, I was going to say, investigative journalism doesn't seem to be as heavy and as cut-thrust as it used to be. I mean, when last did RTE come up with anything very serious about anything? You know, the primetime investigates that we used to have here and there, or what, you know, the kind of stuff that Martí done with the, was it The Independent? Did he work with The Independent when he got stuck into John Delaney of the FAI and stuff like that? Those kind of stories are actually rare. They're good when they come, but they're rare. If The Ditch magazine isn't doing this, who's going to do it? Mm. I mean, RTE at the moment seem to be in a situation that they're far too fearful of upsetting the government in case they do something with their license fee or stuff like that, because they're depending a lot on the hand that feeds them. And they don't seem to be wanting to get into that kind of place at the moment.
But you see, the problem we have with the government too, the problem we have with the government too as well is, they pick and choose their representatives, where they go, when they go, whether there's someone else to debate them or not, whether listeners will be able to engage with them or not. What happens is that RTE News Talk say, right, well, if we want access to such and such a politician, we are going to have to do it on these terms. Now, unfortunately, there are people now that no longer will come on this programme. I don't think this is a particularly controversial programme, to be honest with you. I think we just try and ask the questions. It's not, I'm not a shock jock, right? I don't have any particular leanings in any way, which shape or form. But because some people don't like the line of questioning on serious issues, then all of a sudden they no longer are available. And that an RTE maybe can't afford, or those national stations maybe can't afford to say, right, OK, then if we just won't bring you on then, or you're not coming on, but we're not going to play by your rules. That's not journalism, though.
Greg, is it any wonder then we're all going to Netflix and Amazon Prime if political parties either won't want to engage with national or local media outlets, or they don't want to, or they can't, or whatever? So what's the point then in doing that? Look at the tangle that the BBC got into themselves when they tried to censure Gary Lineker over the comments he made on Twitter about the government's policy on migrants coming into the country. And there was a public outcry about it at the time. But it's very, very clear that the government was wagging their finger at the Director General of the BBC and telling him, you know, to pull him up and pull him into line or whatever. Now, Gary Lineker's back presenting Match of the Day again. But we'll see now, has he curtailed his views or whatever. But governments can do it and they will do it. I mean, way, way back when RTE was set up, I think in 61 or 62, Eamon de Valera, who was, I think he, you know, he was president. Was he president of Taoiseach at the time? He was president, I think, at the time. And he said that this is it had the power to be a force for good, but it also had to be a power to force for bad, and also the negative impact that it would make on the body politic. But it's a poor thing now, you see, if all the media outlets are going to scurry around and try that they don't offend anybody, particularly the government, particularly because there's issues about regulation and control and funding and advertising and so on and so forth. Because all of these outlets are all, at the end of the day, they're commercial outlets. They have to make a profit. Even RT, even though it doesn't make a profit, but it still can't be completely spendthrift or whatever. It has to take cognizance of what it spends.
And Emma, just a final point to you on this. I mean, we are a small population on this island. The way journalists move into government positions, the way heads of organisations move to lobby groups, the way senior members in certain sectors then move into senior roles in private sectors, or a head of one council heads up on the board of something else. Maybe no one wants to fall out with anyone for fear of missing out on a job opportunity. But that's no way. It's no way to get up and go to work in the morning. I mean, how can people, you know?
Yeah, I think this just highlights how important it is to have independent media and how important it is to have investigative journalism, and that we do have a dearth of that in certain terms of the media landscape in Ireland. So that's why pieces that are being done by The Ditch and others are important. And we do have to have that balance between an independent media and, of course, then, you know, we do have a situation where the state broadcaster obviously has its own particular links to the government. And I think that does create challenges.
Yeah. And I think those comments Micheál Martin made about The Ditch and connecting it to Russia is incredibly, incredibly significant. Maybe it doesn't seem so now, but it just is a different turn in terms of the narrative and the conversations out there. Sinn Féin President Michelle O'Neill, Vice President, I beg your pardon, I give her a promotion there. Michelle O'Neill's announced that she will attend the coronation of Britain's King Charles. The party leader at Stormont said the gesture demonstrated her commitment to build good relations, advancing peace and reconciliation. Foyle side People Before Profit Councillor Sean Harkin said, "We can't sit quietly as £100 million and more is squandered on lavishly celebrating a billionaire in a multi-billion institution while children are being targeted with savaged cuts to food grants, speech and therapy supports and so on." I get that, but it's going to happen anyway, whether she's there or not, but yous can discuss that. Leader Pádraig Tobin, obviously they've got an interest in the Northern Ireland elections coming up. He said, Michelle O'Neill attending the coronation of Britain's King Charles confirms and accepts the monarch's position over Northern Ireland. Okay, I'll stay with you on this one, Emma. I try not to get too deep into the ins and outs of it. You know, I don't like toxic politics or toxic sport or anything, so I skirt around the edges. I just thought, right, okay, this is akin to the handshake. This is akin to that image in the church of Arlene and Michelle. I don't know. I just thought, all right, okay, this is progressive, but others, obviously, who know much more than I might, Emma, don't think it's a good thing, but I want to know what you think.
Well, I mean, I think that there's an election in 3 weeks, and so a lot of that... A lot of that commentary from competing parties is rooted in the fact that people in Northern Ireland will be going to the polls. You know, obviously we had the handshake not too long ago in terms of Michelle O'Neill and Alex Maskey meeting with the King then, and they had a very warm exchange. This is, I think, completely unsurprising that Sinn Féin have taken this position where they are going to attend. I think it does show leadership and is part of a broader transformation that the party has been undergoing in terms of its transition into being very slick with its PR, in terms of trying to move forward with its image and trying to show that the party is able to represent more than one community. Michelle O'Neill is the first minister in waiting, and the language from a PR perspective is very good messaging in terms of really trying to hammer home this message that she will be a first minister for all. That would be wonderful if we could have that in Northern Ireland.
And in that, Emma, if she didn't accept this invitation, then it would have made those words incredibly hollow.
Exactly. It would have completely undercut their entire messaging over the last couple of years that they've been building up to. So this was a natural response. I think it is welcome in Northern Ireland because we do have an extremely divisive political system. We have a political ideology and unionism that really is struggling with a position now where they have become a minority in our political system, with the DUP now waiting to take the position of deputy first minister for the first time if they ever decide to take up that position and allow us to have some kind of functioning government. So we have quite we've got changing landscapes here in terms of the political position in Northern Ireland, and Sinn Féin are, I think, from a PR perspective, doing a very good job at changing their messaging. I think if they had not done that, it would have just created a really negative media cycle and discourse cycle around politics here in Northern Ireland. And
all right, but what about then? I mean, obviously we have to move forward, but I mean, you could trace Charles's connection back to the army and back to Derry very, very quickly. And for some people, that's still very raw, very recent.
We are a post-conflict society.
Yeah.
And that is extremely challenging. And a bigger issue that we have here is the fact that we haven't addressed much of the legacy of the past, that we aren't ensuring that we have policies and procedures in place where people can access truth and justice. We have a situation where families are spending decades trying to go through the court system to try and get some kind of truth and justice for their loved ones. And that has a knock-on effect across society. And there's a bigger thing here as well in terms of how we as a society across this entire island actually look at the past and how we reflect on what really happened here over the last number of decades. Mm. So there is that issue at play. And of course, there are a lot of people who have very raw emotions that the past is not that far away from them. And I think that that's a burden that many people carry on their shoulders. But at the same time, we are a post-conflict society. We have now been operating under the Good Friday Agreement for 25 years. There is a need to progress forward and to accept that what happened in the past is not what's happening today, and people are able to change. They are able to move forward, and we have seen that with what happened in the run-up to the Good Friday Agreement, when, for example, the IRA put down their arms and opted to go into politics in terms of constitutional politics as the way forward. So we have to sort of try and couple that and move forward as a society and accept that we do need to have some kind of normalization of politics and some kind of normalization of how we see these things. I think that this was a good move by Sinn Féin. Certainly not doing so would have been much worse.
Yeah, and it kind of feels to me like she probably shouldn't have, but probably has to. And I don't mean that as a politically comment, but that's the dilemma, I suppose. Paddy, what do you think?
Well, I suppose, can I put my cards on the table here, Greg, at the outset, and say that I'm not a fan of monarchies anywhere, right? And I'm not targeting the
neither
British
am I for that
here.
Matter. I think I find it ridiculous.
The whole idea that somebody can be born into a family and there's automatic power and privilege, whether it's ceremonial power or executive power, where there is no mandate and no accountability, it's just bizarre to me. It's sort of a 14th century concept as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, that's the by and by. If it's a British thing, if they like it, happy days as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
If I was advising Michelle O'Neill, I would advise her 100% to go to it. Because politics is the art of the possible, and it's all about building up networks and relationships and allies and stuff like that. There is a short clip of an interview between whatever journalist, I'm not sure at this point, and a chap called Leonard Hutchinson. He was a member of Derry City Council. He was a member of the Ulster Unionist Party. And this interview took place somewhere in the mid-1960s because it's black and white, and the glasses and the attire leads me to believe it's around that time. And he's speaking in the most derogatory terms about the Catholic nationalist population in Derry, about their overbreeding and their lack of work ethic and so on and so forth. And he gave the very clear impression that the gerrymandering and the discrimination and the unionist-controlled dormant government was there to protect the nationalists from themselves.
Right,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, that political architecture in Northern Ireland had to be tumbled by fair and foul means, because that attitude was prevalent in Northern Ireland. And I bet you if you scrape the surface, you'll find that's still there, not to the same degree, but around at some minor level. And that had to be taken down, and the civil rights movement took it down. And the state's response to the civil rights movement, you know, let the genie out of the bottle, and there was political violence, and that brought down the rest of it. And that whole thing has been recreated again. Anything at all that Michelle O'Neill does has to be done for a purpose. And Emma there articulated very well about King Charles when he was visiting all, let's call them the four home countries after Queen Elizabeth's death, and he came to Belfast. And the Unionist parties, particularly the DUP, were apoplectic with rage because he met the First Minister designate from Sinn Féin, he met the Lord Mayor of Belfast from Sinn Féin, and he met the Speaker of Stormont from Sinn Féin. And they were almost pushed to the background. In fact, I don't think Geoffrey Donaldson, the leader of the DUP, has actually got an invite to the coronation, if my memory strikes me right. So why wouldn't she go? Because they are now, the Sinn Féin are now becoming the good guys. Yesterday, for instance, and Emma, you'll be very familiar with this, the British government announced their budget, and Northern Ireland has been slashed. And its commentary somewhere said that it was a budget to punish the DUP, but it turns out that it's a 10% cut in real term, taking inflation into account. And Jane Brady, the head of the civil service in Northern Ireland, that it was going to cause unprecedented and enduring harm to society in Northern Ireland because the effect it was going to have on public services. So I'm all for her going.
Okay.
I'm all for her glad handling, and I'm all for her doing it for a particular reason so that she can build her kudos at home.
All right, Paddy, listen, thank you very much as always. Paddy Rooney, okay. PRO of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. Great to have you on. Emma, great to have you on as well. Thank you so much for your time, and hopefully you'll come back.
Absolutely. Have
excellent.
A
that's
day.
Good
Take
to
care.
Hear. You too.
Bye,
that's Emma D'Souza, writer, campaigner, peace builder, and founder of the Civic Initiative.